Well, Mother Sullivan's up in Scotland. Sounds like a good place. We're going to try and arrange a Kendall Whaling Museum Mystic Seaport field trip to Mother Sullivan's. So bring your easy virtue. For all their good work, folklorists have consistently, for good professional reasons, I might add, but consistently, nevertheless, overlooked the other very important side of music on shipboard, ashore and not. Stan Hugel was singing a few old songs yesterday, just before things got underway. Said his father used to sing most of them. All of them are, you know, fancy published songs of the late 19th century, things that were popular when his dad was a young man. And it was a few years ago here that we began doing some presentations on that genre of music. Last year, you may remember, we had a paper by John Townley on Dibdin and his composed songs. Caroline Moseley has spoken about parlor songs at sea and parlor songs of the sea and stereotypes of women in sailor songs and parlor song. One of the chief practitioners of the fine art of sailor's parlor songs of the sea. Last time Helen spoke here, I came up with something of which I'm really quite proud because it does describe the two different genres of songs of the sea. One of them is what Helen does, which are parlor songs of sea disasters. We'll be hearing some of that from Jacek and Tom and Mary a little later. The other genre is sea songs of parlor disasters. We know from Gail Huntington's collection that at least half the songs that he found in manuscript, in whaling manuscripts, are these parlor songs, composed songs, art songs, as it were. We know from Melville that some of the most, and from Dana that some of the most common songs on shipboard were, that sailors sang, were songs of known composers, known provenance, publishing date, sheet music, and the whole business, the stuff that we folk singers don't normally sing. These have been collected in oral tradition, they just aren't printed in the books, and you can tell that if you take a look at Bruce Rosenberg's index of the folk songs found in Virginia, half of them are composed songs, but when you take a look at the Davis anthology of those songs, only the ballads are included and nothing else. So there's a bias there that we're trying to correct right here on this stage. And if you're interested in hearing some of the songs that were current in the late 19th century, maybe we can get Stan to do a program next time around of some of those late 19th century songs of just the vintage of the ones that Helen Gordon is going to do for us now. This guy, Stephen Adams, when she said something about Stephen Adams, I vaguely remembered his name. They're a little later than the songs that I'm doing in my own work, but some of the great sea songs are by this guy. How many here have ever heard of Stephen Adams before now? Zero. You see? But you'll probably recognize some of the songs, and I'm sure you'll recognize Helen Gordon, even though she's bringing a silent partner with her today. So from the Sea Education Association in beautiful Woods Hole, Massachusetts, our friend and previous speaker on the on this stage and future speaker, we hope, here she comes with piano, Helen Gordon.
Hello. I am here to continue my crusade to bring parlor songs out of dusty closets being dusty as opposed to museums and archives, and back to the drawing room, if not before paying audiences. And the composer we're looking at today, Stephen Adams, lived during the second half of the 19th century and on into the 20th. His dates are 1844 to 1913. Before we go into him, we have to quickly review some parlor song characteristics so that it's not all going out your ear. The first thing you have to remember in a parlor song is that the role of the singer and the pianist is seen as equal, and that role is to present text without being obtrusive. The text is the all-important thing. Another thing that a parlor composer keeps in mind is that the melody and the accompaniment have to be kept simple enough to allow most amateurs to perform them adequately. I mean, after all, you were selling these songs and trying to get big, huge sheet music sales, and it doesn't help if no one can play them. The music is regularly divided into 4 or 8 measure phrases, and you see a lot of repetition of melodic ideas, both within songs and from song to song. There was a general feeling that composers used a common subconscious pool of ideas, and they would just draw on this, and that's why so many songs sound the same. They sound familiar. This was considered okay, and it was not considered plagiarism or anything. And it was something you desired, because then, again, a familiar song is going to sell better. Text is all important, and the first idea of text is to tell a story, usually of an improving nature, or to evoke an emotion in the listener. That's another very important one. And also to entertain the listener, to help pass the evening pleasantly. Songs were popularized in the last quarter of the 19th century via ballad concerts, where you'd get a bunch of famous singers to all sing songs of different publishers for the publishers. Singers received royalties from the publishers for presenting songs to the public. I have a quote without the paper. It's interesting to note, though, that where a singer gets a huge royalty for singing a song, bringing it to the public, and then if it catches on, he gets paid to keep it in his repertoire. A composer just sells something outright for a small fee, and occasionally would get a royalty upon public performance, but it was usually much smaller. The other thing that's interesting is the appearance of the sheet music often will have the name of the singer in bigger type than the name of the composer or the poet, and often, not often, sometimes, you'll not even see the name of the composer or the poet on there. One song by Stephen Adams, which is called The Holy City, and is his, in my paper, it's our representative religious song by Stephen Adams. In 1899, Edward Lloyd, who was a tenor, was quoted in a musical journal called The Musical Times as saying that The Holy City was the most popular song in his repertoire. It sells at the rate of 50,000 copies per year. In Montreal, I was engaged to sing four times in 1 month at a fee of 250 guineas each concert, on condition that I sang The Holy City on each occasion. What's interesting about this song is when I was going over it with my illustrator, Tom Gu, I started playing it and his face blanched. And he said, "Oh no, that?" He says, "I imagine a soprano in a church with an out-of-tune piano." And so I gather it is still sung quite often today.
It'll be sung tomorrow somewhere.
Yes, right, it's offertory anthem. Anyway, going on. Stephen Adams is a pseudonym. Pseudonyms are common in parlor song works. It's the pseudonym of Michael Maybrick. And Michael Maybrick was also famous. Michael Maybrick was known for singing the songs of Stephen Adams. So he was pretty smart there. He started out training as an organist, but as a contemporary biographer puts it, he wisely sacrificed his contrapuntal studies to devote his attention to vocal cultivation. And his publisher Boosey, one of the big publishers in England, relates a little story about how one evening when James Molloy, who's another famous parlor performer and composer, and Stephen Adams, Michael Maybrick, were having dinner together, and they'd been dining rather well, and they were walking home, James Molloy said to Michael Maybrick, "You've got a splendid voice, Maybrick. What a pity you wasted on those rubbishy songs of Stephen Adams." So he kept himself separate from his pseudonym. However, he had the best of both worlds. That means he sold the songs, and he also got to sing them for royalties. He often collaborated with the lyricist Frederick E. Weatherly, who may be familiar to you, but you don't know it. He's one of the most prolific and most deft of parlor song poets. He's the same guy who wrote Danny Boy. And he also wrote The Holy City's words, which we won't be singing today. Today we're really going to talk on his trademarks. I'm not really going to talk that much. We're going to sing them. And his trademark is sea songs. And the ones included, they fall into two stylistic groups. The first group includes songs like The Midship Mite, The Tar's Farewell, and one that probably more of you are familiar with, Nancy Lee. At least you may have heard the name. And the second group includes The Heart of a Sailor and They All Love Jack. The stylistic elements of the first group are, besides having a verse followed by a chorus, there's a mini chorus in the verse that reminds one of the solo response form you see in sea shanties. In a sense, it's homogenizing shanties for middle-class parlor consumption, bringing them in and making people think they're singing something very, I don't know how to express that, but something very meaty, and yet keeping it very genteel so that it can fit into the parlor category. This mini chorus occurs on lines 1, 2, and 4 of the verse, and then you have a full chorus afterwards. The sentiments of these songs are uplifting, though somewhat unrealistic. There's a big difference in the tone of a parlor song about the sea than a sea shanty or a traditional, the other bias, as they say. The Midshipmite is a heroic, self-sacrificing tale of bravery, and another aspect of that is faithful friends sticking together. We have a heroic little midshipman going ashore to spike the enemy's guns, and he gets hurt, and he tells everybody to go back without him. And they say, of course we won't, and they take him with them and save him. And the one we're going to perform for you now is called The Tar's Farewell. And if you listen to the song, you will hear, first of all, the verse is in duple meter, and then Adams uses a transition to prepare you for the chorus, and then the chorus he lets go in triple meter. And there is a lot of melodic repetition that you will hear. And the storyline is of a faithful sailor off on a long voyage, pledging to return to the first love of his heart. And at least in this song, there is a human note of retribution. And you will note that in the second verse. So Tom, why don't you come up? And we will attempt this in the true parlor amateur style.
Well, it's not the true parlor amateur style.
That's true. You don't have
a
coat.
I should have a tailcoat, and you certainly wouldn't be out looking
right.
Like that.
It's not possible for you to stand over here, is it?
Yep.
When forced to bid farewell to Lul, pull away, my boys, pull away. I did not know what I should do. Pull away, pull away. I left her weeping on the quay. She said she would be so true to me as I sailed away to the southern sea. Pull away, my boys, pull away. Pull away, pull away, pull away. The wind must blow and the ship must go and the loving souls must part. But the ship will tack and the tar come back to the first love of his heart. For the wind must blow and the ship must go and the loving souls must part. And the ship will tack and the tar come back to the first love of his heart, to the first love of his heart. But then if faults should prove my fair, pull away, my boys, pull away. I'd burn this little lock of hair, pull away, pull away. And she be false and I be free, I'll sail again to the southern sea, where there are plenty good as she. Pull away, my boys, pull away. Pull away, pull away, pull away. For the wind must blow and the ship must go and the loving souls must part. But the ship will tack and the tar come back to the first love of his heart. For the wind must blow and the ship must go and the loving souls must part. And the ship will tack and the tar come back to the first love of his heart, to the first love of his
gets a chance to sing baritone because everybody knows he can sing first tenor. All right, our next example comes from the second stylistic group. This group is more through composed. It's a verse and a full chorus. You don't find the mini chorus. There's a humorous and clever tone that's not as apparent in the earlier ones. They all love Jack, which is one we hope we don't have to sing because of time, is delightfully clever logic. It's only because we haven't rehearsed it quite as often. It has delightfully clever logic in it, that every woman in the world loves sailors, so therefore the sailor must be the king of all men because all women love sailors.
Would you just like me to give that a verse?
Oh, if you'd like to, Stan, that'd be
ready, and the jolly days are come, when the last goodbyes are whispered, and Jack abroad is gone. The lassies fall a-weeping as they watch the vessel's track. For all you landsmen lovers, you're nothing after Jack. For all the landsmen lovers are nothing after Jack. For his heart is like the sea, ever open, brave and free, and the girls must only be until his ship comes back. For if love's the best of all that can a man befall, well, Jack's the king of all, for they all love Jack.
Thank you. Well, our other example is The Heart of a Sailor, and this one might well remind you of the Gilbert and Sullivan genre of patter song. It's humorous tone, and it is through composed. There's not melodic repetition in the verse. The chorus is very repetitious, but that's all right. The second verse, you might want to particularly pay attention to the lyrics because it points out unusual benefits of marrying a sailor. Mr. Goop. We can't take it too fast.
Now who's the man for a lass to wed, to be true and never fail her? You may trust to me, for I've sailed the sea. There's none like an honest sailor, for his thoughts are free as the wind or sea, and he's got such a dash of the briny. His heart is light and his laugh so bright, he makes life all sunshine. He may sail in a smack or a man o' war or aboard of an Arctic whaler, but it's all the same if Jack's his name and he's got the heart of a sailor. Then he has to be so oft at sea, which saves a deal of bother, for husbands and wives don't always agree as they should with one another. And if he flirts with one or two in ports of every nation, you can all do the same without any blame, which is surely a consolation. He may sail in a smack or a man o' war or aboard of an Arctic whaler, but it's all the same if Jack's his name and he's got the heart of a sailor. So lasses all, when he comes to you and declares his adoration, your love confess and answer yes without any hesitation. For he's the man for a lassie's hand, to be true and never fail her. And of all the husbands in the land, there's none like a true-born sailor. He may sail in a smack or a man o' war or aboard of an Arctic whaler, But it's all the same if Jack's his name, and he's got the heart of a sailor.
Our third example that we want to present to you is the one that is probably the most well-known today of Stephen Adams' songs. And this is Nancy Lee. Now let me just get out my notes here. Nancy Lee was written in 1876. And it was so popular in England alone in 18 months, it sold 70,000 copies. And it was also so popular that Punch magazine was able to publish a cartoon of 10 young baritones all showing up at an evening party with Nancy Lee stuck under their arms as their little piece that they were going to sing. Nancy Lee is the idealized picture of a sailor's wife. Very idealized. She's ever faithful. She's watching and worrying for him. She's a good housekeeper and a homemaker. And she is the guiding light of the sailor's existence. The piece is in 6/8 time throughout, and you'll see that there's a very regular pattern. The verse has the melodic form of a phrase A, and then a variation on it, and then a phrase B, and a variation on it, and then the chorus is a phrase C, and a variation on that. The other thing that's interesting about this piece is the way one can, oh, it's interesting in all parlor songs, and this one illustrates it too, is the way with very few chords you can change things around just enough to keep it interesting to the Victorian ear. And that's one thing when we do listen to these, we are not listening to them with 1980s ears, at least when we're singing them. We're trying to sing them and perform them and listen to them as they would have been heard 100 years ago, where diminished chords were a big thing. And 5/7 chords were a pretty big thing. So you have to remember this when you're listening to these. And I think we'll just perform Nancy Lee.
Is the sailor's wife barefoot and pregnant?
Tom! Oh. Fitz. He wasn't home often enough.
I see.
Of all the wives as e'er you know.
A little slower.
Of all the wives as e'er you know, your lads ho, your lads ho, there's none like Nancy Lee I draw. Your lads ho, your. See, there she stands and waves her hand upon the quay. And every day when I'm away, she'll watch for me. And whisper low when tempests blow for Jack at sea. Yo-ho, lads, ho, yo-ho. The sailor's wife, the sailor's star shall be. Yo-ho, we go across the sea. The sailor's wife, the sailor's star shall be. The sailor's wife, his star shall be.
You're all welcome to join in this very easy chorus.
The sailor's star shall be.
The harbors past the breezes blow. Yo-ho, lads, ho. Yo-ho, lads, ho. Yes, long ere we come back, I know. Yo-ho, lads, ho. Yo-ho. But true and bright from morn till night my home will be, and also neat and snug and sweet for Jack at sea, and Nancy's face to bless the place and welcome me. Yo-ho, lads, ho, yo-ho. The sailor's wife, the sailor's star, shall be yo-ho, lads, ho, yo-ho, lads, ho. The sailor's wife, the sailor's star, shall be the sailor's wife, his star shall be. The bo'sun pipes the watch below. Yo-ho, lads-ho, yo-ho, lads-ho. Then here's a health before we go. Yo-ho, lads-ho, yo-ho. A long, long life to my sweet wife and mates at sea, and keep my bones from Davy Jones where'er we be. And may you meet a mate as sweet as Nancy Lee. Yo-ho, lads, ho, yo-ho. The sailor's wife, the sailor's star, shall be yo-ho, lads, ho. We go across the sea. The sailor's wife, the sailor's star, shall be the sailor's wife, his star shall be.
I just want to point out that although Stephen Adams wrote non-seasongs, seasongs were the trademark that he was best known for. And it's lovely to listen to all the different ways he can take a different topic and bring it to you. Even within the topic, one topic of a seasong can bring a lot of different sentiments across. And he keeps things from being too sugary in comparison to other parlor songs. And I just hope that people will, if they see these in a book, actually hum them out, because his songs deserve to be sung today just as they were 100 years ago. Thank you.
Very nice indeed. Thank you. Wonderful paper. I had a talker into doing this twice. And thank you very much, Tom. Now, it's a story about Fred Weatherly and Stephen Adams going to a cocktail party together, Mr. and Mrs. Adams, Mr. and Mrs. Weatherly. And, Mrs. Weatherly is standing along and having cocktails, and one of the ladies comes up and says, "Isn't that Stephen Adams over there?" And she says, "Yes, that is Stephen Adams, my husband's partner." Didn't he write Nancy Lee? No, Fred Weatherly wrote Nancy Lee. He wrote da 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 da. So Helen Gordon and Tom Gu next appearing at the False Moonbeam Cafe in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. The next speaker needs no introduction, and consequently he won't get one. Continuing in the correcting misimpressions department, this little piece is called Shantying Aboard American Whale Ships. And I know it's something that you all want to know all about. There is a persistent rumor that there wasn't any. That is, that people on whale ships didn't shanty. The idea is that the shanties are only useful when you're underhanded. When you're underhanded, as we all know, especially in pirate ships, where everyone is underhanded. When ships are short-handed, in order to be able to walk beneath the overhead. The idea being, of course, if you have a large crew proportionate to the amount of work that needs to be done, you really don't need a shanty because the coordination isn't so important there. And if you were to read Richard Henry Dana and most other square-rig merchant sailors, whalemen are generically uncoordinated. It isn't that there were no shanties on shipboard isn't the sort of thing that you read in the scholarly literature. But you do hear it occasionally on the concert stage. You hear it a lot in Scuttlebutt. Even Stan Hugel has said it a couple of times. I'm sure he didn't mean it.
Let me just jump in there. The ones they sang, we don't know.
The ones, well...
The cruise and the castle up is about six. And then the log of the sea wave, there's another...
Well, we'll cover that in a moment. I think I'll give you about 35 shanties that were sung on whale ships in the next 20 minutes or so. I'm not going to sing them all, but Stan will sing them all later. Anyway. One wonders where all this came from. Certainly, we don't know which shanties are, there isn't a large advertisement at the beginning of each whaling museum telling you which shanties were sung on whale ships. But there's an awful lot of information sort of on the contrary, and probably the worst offender is Clifford Ashley, celebrated as the greatest, but probably the least effective of all the major historians of whaling. And he says, in the first edition of his book, The Yankee Whaler, he doesn't say word one about shanties and very little about songs. And in the second, that generated a lot of letters, because when that book came out, there was already a big controversy in the Mariner's Mirror in London and in some of the periodicals here about songs and shanties in the 20s, becoming sort of popular. And he said in the preface to his first edition, the sea shanty developed spontaneously in the merchant service, where it served a very definite purpose on ships of many nations until donkey engines superseded manpower on deck. On the whaler, however, its employment was intermittent and generally incidental. It never became an important part of daily life on the whaleman. Once on the whaling ground, during daytime, all unnecessary noise was discouraged, and that's a significant point I wish you'd remember. He's quite right. Even orders were given in lowered voices so that the whales might not be frightened off. Usually in the dog watches, all hands were permitted to dance, sing, and play whatever musical instruments they had. Well, we know that was true more often on whale ships than any others because they had a lot of free time. They closed down at night, you know, working hours ended at dark, and then you had until the next sunrise before the watch was posted again aloft to look for whales. But there was no occasion for shantying after the lookout had once left the masthead. For ships were then under shortened sail until sunup. The one purpose of the sea shanty was to lend rhythm to heavy hauling. Now, in the strictest definition of shanties that Stan gave us last night, there's some case to be made that shanties were not terribly common on whale ships, but I don't know whether we'd all agree that what we mean by a shipboard work song, at least, if not a shanty, is limited to heavy hauling. Sometimes when getting up anchor or when cutting in a whale, there would be a burst of a shanty. When homeward bound with a full ship crew off in shanty, but it was then more an expression of their gladness of heart than it was an adjunct to their work. Whalers were small and watches disproportionately large. About 40 hands all towed made up the crew of an average vessel, and of course that's inaccurate. I don't know of a single whale ship that ever sailed out of a New England port with more than 37 men aboard. In consequence, and most of them were much less, in consequence, working ship was mere child's play beside the heavy grind aboard a more short-handed merchantman. There, every pound a man possessed had to be brought to bear on his task. And this is all, I mean, we know this to be standard shanty information. I would like to claim the shanty for whalemen, but in all fairness, it appears to belong to the merchant service, where it originated, developed, and became obsolete in so short a space of time that the lifespan of many a sailor bridged the whole period. Well, that makes a lot of sense, but it just isn't true. I mean, there were shanties on whale ships for whatever reasons. But this same attitude is reflected in the book called Whaling Masters, which was something done by the WPA. It was a compilation of statistics to tell you who was the captain of what vessel. The guys in the whaling business use it every day. Bob Webb, every day we take it off the shelf to look stuff up. And they suggested that there wasn't any shantying on a whale ship except when the whale ship was lucky enough to possess a natural song leader. They never really were much a part of life on whalers. But Whaling Masters disagrees with Ashley about when they were used on shipboard, if they were used at all. They claim that when shanties were used at all, they were used on the long haul back to the ship to lighten the back-breaking toil of towing a dead whale's bulky carcass or while manning the capstan. Most of them were the inspiration of the ship's song leader. And then they go on to say, Neptune was no censor, and the robust wit of these improvisations, sung only out of hearing of the old man, had its chief sources in the lively libels on the master's ancestry or the popularity of this or that girl at the last port visited. Ribald profanity spiced the hearty dish to a whaleman's none too delicate taste. Well, perhaps apart from their inordinate preoccupation with the racy verses, which, by the way, they do not print, these paragraphs seem to be self-contradictory. It's really difficult to agree with them that a tradition that was, quote, never really as much part of the life on the whalers as on the merchantmen, unquote, is worth all of the prose they devote to explaining about the ribald profanity and how whalemen were so cute that they could only do lascivious songs. But more importantly, merely because the function of shanties was not the same on whale ships as on merchant vessels doesn't mean that there weren't any and that they weren't important. Really, what criteria do Ashley and the whaling and whaling masters apply when they claim that shantying was never really part of the life of a whaleman and never became an important part of the daily life on whale ships? Is frequency of use to be the criterion? Or might there be a qualitative subtlety here that eludes Ashley? In this connection, he says he's quite in error when he says that heavy hauling was the one and only purpose of the shanty. It would seem that his observation that, quote, when homeward bound with a full ship, the crew often shantied, but it was more of an expression of their gladness of heart than an adjunct to their work, end quote, is sufficient to point up his misreading of the ulterior purpose of shanties, at least in this instance, which was as much to lift the spirit as to hoist the yard. As Richard Henry Dana says in 2 years Before the Mast, a song is necessary to sailors as the drum and fife to a soldier. They can't pull in time or pull with a will without it. Many a time when a thing goes heavy with one fellow, yo-ho-hoing a lively song has put strength into every arm. And these sentiments from Dana in 1840 are echoed and expanded in considerable detail by many whalemen, among them Walter Noble Burns, who I'll quote again later. He wrote a book called A Year with a Whaler about his voyage about 1890 in a New Bedford whale ship. At the cutting in of this whale, I had my first experience at the windlass. The heaviest labor falls to the sailors who man the windlass and hoist in the great blanket pieces of blubber and the old head. Gabriel, the happiest spirited old soul aboard, bossed the job, as he always did, and cheered the sailors and made the hard work seem like play by his constant shanties, those catchy, tuneful working songs of the sea. All the old sailors on the brig knew these songs by heart. Now, there's the significant thing. You do have the charismatic song leader, old Gabriel. He's the, you know, the what whaling masters would call the exception to the rule, the fellow who's an energetic song leader. But all the old sailors on the brig knew these songs by heart and often sang them on the topsail halyard or while reefing on the topsail yard. He's distinguishing between old sailors and green hands, who in the singing of the songs are learning them and passing them along. These are the same songs, of course, that came down to our century and to Stan and from Stan to us. The green hand soon picked up the words and airs of the choruses and joined in. The day laborer on land has no idea what work at, how work at sea is lightened by these songs. Maybe Ashley would have appreciated that effect more if he hadn't left his ship, the Sunbeam, at Brava. He was on board for 3 months. He talks about the homeward bound voyage, but he wasn't on it. He cut in only a couple of whales before he left, and I don't know how he's able to talk about the homeward bound voyage without having been there. Well, whatever the explanation for the lack of shanties on whale ships in some instances, or for Ashley's failure to understand the importance of them in the Sunbeam, it cannot be that there never was a shanty tradition of much importance in whale ships. The evidence to the contrary is just simply too overwhelming. And in fact, Ashley commits the most common fallacy of the folk informant and the latter-day amateur, that of generalizing from the particular. That is, he induces or interpolates from the limited sphere of his own experience, in this case, the only one vessel over a period of only a few months, less than a complete voyage, in a latter-day phase of a once great industry already in its death throes, not peopled by the original Yankee sailors who created the fishery. To make broad generalizations about history and universal practice, it's one thing for him to say, there weren't any shanties on my ship, so I don't know much about that, what might have been before. But no, he says, they never were. They didn't need them. Because there was no shantying in my ship when I was in the whale fishery, there never was much shantying aboard whale ships. And shantying couldn't have been important to them, because I'm one of them, and shantying wasn't important to me or to us. Against the objections of better testimony, such a first-hand informant falls back on the claim that he was there and he should know. This would be dangerous and conclusive if we didn't have very good evidence to the contrary. We've got whalemen going all the way back to the 1840s, including Melville along the way, who have other things to say about it. Herman Melville, if you choose to believe him, now we have a writer who is more interested in metaphysics and style, perhaps, in Moby Dick than he is in communicating just the facts, ma'am. But apart from the allegorical and metaphysical significance, which I deal with in my article on the subject, by the way, I mean, if you want to know about shanties in Melville and you want to read what I have to say about it, the New England Quarterly sometime this year is going to publish this article called Shantying in the Pequod. And I treat the several shanties I'm about just a list here that Melville mentions and uses. In O Moo, which is the sequel to Typee and has to do with whalemen on the beach, as it were, in the South Pacific. At one point, two sailors and a bunch of landlubbers are trying to pull a tree stump out of the ground, and one of them starts up a shanty, "Were You Ever in Dumbarton?" This is one that appears in Dorflinger's collection. And Stan suggests that it's a version of, or the descendant of, "Oh, If I Had Her." And I think Stan is probably right about that. We don't know the text that Melville used, but in any case, they start singing this thing, and this Down East guy tells him, "Shut up, you know, it's too filthy, we don't want to hear it." In another instance, during a drunken revelry in Anchorage Harbor, they start singing "The Coast of Barbary," which is only controversially a shanty and may not be intended as such here. And twice during drunken revelries, and another time, the men actually working ship on the Lucy Ann of Sydney, Australia, they sing "Cheerily Man," which is one of the old English shanties. My guess is it probably predates most of the black influence, and I imagine Stan will probably agree with that. Dana also mentions "Cheerily Man," and it's probably one of the oldest surviving shanties, at least from the 19th century tradition. In Moby Dick, they pump ship aboard Town Ho to a shanty, which is unfortunately not named. They weigh anchor in Nantucket Harbor aboard the Pequod to a shanty, and there's a nice little quote there. This also has serious metaphysical and theological significance, but I'm not going to go into that here. In getting underway, Bildad, I say, might now be seen actively engaged in looking over the bows for the approaching anchor, and at intervals singing what seemed a dismal stave of psalmody to cheer the hands at the windlass, who roared forth some sort of chorus about the girls of Booble Alley with a hearty goodwill. And that, of course, is either Round the Corner Sally or perhaps Rosie. And if you want to read about Booble Alley, you can take a look at Sailor Town, which is, in my article, what I quoted about Booble Alley. It's about the most colorful passage you can find. It's a place in Liverpool where packet sailors and wharf rats used to hang out and steal things from one another. But here, of course, the juxtaposition, which typifies the use of shanties in Melville, and they have a very specific and useful purpose in his literature, is that while Bildad, the hypocritical Quaker owner of the ship, is distributing Bibles and singing religious songs, the men are singing over this Booble Alley song about whores and drunkenness and so on in Booble Alley, Liverpool. Finally, in Moby Dick, there's a cutting-in shanty, which is not named. While they're cutting in a whale, and this is a portent, as Melville might say, of what's to come, because they never do get a chance to cut in Moby Dick. Of course, Moby Dick and Omoo are based on the literal truth of Melville's experience and his vast researches, mostly in John Ross Brown and other whaling narratives of the immediately preceding period. They are meaningful, symbolic, metaphysical, and allegorical, and we don't have time to go into all of that, but he does have them in the context of shanties. But if you don't want to believe him, if that's not good enough for you, if that's just literature and not intended to be fact, and that's, you can make a good case for that. You can't believe what Melville says because he's creating art, not facts. Just take a look at some of the guys whose only real aim is to tell you the facts and put them into a colorful context to make it interesting reading so you'll buy the book. Chronologically, these range from Olmsted's Incidents of a Whaling Voyage, which was published in 1841. That's 1 year after, 2 years before the mast. And both Hugel and Dorflinger and others have described that as being probably the earliest text in which shipboard work songs of any kind are included with musical notation. And that's a whaling narrative. Up to Walter Noble Burns, the fellow I talked about later, whose narrative was published in 1913 of his 1890s voyage. So at least from that period, which in my view, 72 years spans more than the working career of just one sailor. Shanties seem to have been very active on whale ships. Olmsted, Francis Allen Olmsted's Incidents of a Whaling Voyage, was probably the first account of life at sea ever to give shipboard work songs with tunes. And his catalog of shanties used during the voyage, during 1839 to 41 in the New London whale ship North America, includes sing-outs at the ropes and the windlass. Okay. So we've got heaving and hauling shanties. He said, "I've often been very much amused by the cries and songs of the men when engaged in hauling away upon the rigging of the ship. The usual cry is ho, 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 or ho, ho, heave-o, which is sung by some of them, while the rest keep time. It has a rather dolorous cadence and a wildness that sounds like a note of distress when rising above the roar of the gale at dead of night." Well, Stan can do that in broad daylight. He also mentions full-scale shantying at the Halyards, the kind that Stan was talking about last night is the only real shanty, which he describes in much brighter terms. He says, there are many songs in common use among seamen of very lively character, which though bereft of all sentiment and sense in many instances, are performed with very good effect when there is a long line of men hauling together. Mr. Freeman, the black shanty man, usually officiates as chorister, with many numerous demi-semi-quavers, and he mentions the word, demi-semi-quavers, which Stan calls hitches, strikes up the song while all the rest join in the chorus. Sometimes they all sing together as I've endeavored to represent, although it must appear very tame without the attendant circumstances. One of the songs is as follows, and this is the old chestnut, first time it's in print, first shanty ever to be printed with musical notation. Ho, ho, and up she rises, ho, ho, and up she rises, ho, ho, and up she rises early in the morning.